This episode of Biscuits and Jam is presented by Boar's Head. Welcome to Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living. I'm your host, Sid Evans, and today I'm talking with someone who's thought a lot about what it takes to be both a father and a son. Today's show co-host Craig Melvin grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, in a diverse neighborhood he loved, but a household that had its challenges. His 2021 memoir, Pops, Learning to Be a Son and a Father, dealt with his experiences living with a dad who was an alcoholic and a gambling addict. And writing the book ultimately helped him overcome the past and salvage the relationship. Now he's written a new children's book called I'm Proud of You that explores the important role parents play in raising confident kids. We'll talk about all that, plus his mother Betty Jo's mac and cheese, the best advice he's gotten from other dads about being a father, and why he's already planning a second children's book on this week's Biscuits and Jam. Craig Melvin, welcome to Biscuits and Jam.
I love biscuits. I love jam. I love Southern Living, Sid, so I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's great to see you. Great to have you here. First things first, I've got to ask, how's Betty Jo?
I'm surprised how many people start with that. Mom is doing fantastic. She's doing better than fantastic. I saw her 2 weekends in a row. She came up to Connecticut where we live. One weekend, she came just to sort of hang out. And then Dad came back with her the very next weekend because our daughter was getting baptized and it was Easter. So we spent Easter together, baptism together. And in fact, I did the math in March into April. I saw Betty Jo 9 days. It's pretty good.
That's a lot of Betty Jo time. That's great.
And she's not wild about traveling either. So especially coming to the Northeast when it's not the late spring or summer, there's a constant complaint about how cold it is and the temperature. And even after, 13 years, it's still brand new to her. She's doing very well.
Well, Craig, I just got to say congrats on the new children's book. It's called I'm Proud of You, and it's beautifully done. I've got a copy sitting right here. When did you first come up with this idea?
A couple years ago, I put out a book. It was a love letter to my father, who struggled with addictions and struggled with a host of things for most of his life. And then several years ago, cleaned up and is now the kind of father and grandfather that I wish he had been when I was a kid. And I wrote that book, Pops, during the pandemic. It was cathartic for me. He thoroughly enjoyed it as well, but it took a lot out of me. It was pretty heavy. And so while I was working on that book, someone suggested that I should maybe write something a little lighter the second time. And so I still wanted to write something that mattered to me, but also mattered to someone else that I cared about. So the first time it was a love letter to my dad. This time it's a love letter to my son and my daughter, and also to just fatherhood in general. This was a lot more fun to work on than the first one, and I got just as much out of it.
Yeah, I've got the first book here, too, and yeah, it's a very, very different book, and I want to talk about that a little bit later, but the two definitely seem connected to me. And those words, the title of the book, I'm Proud of You, I mean, those are some powerful words.
They are, and you don't realize it sometimes because, you and I, we're older gentlemen. Not old, just older. And I think that when you're young, those formative years, and this is not obviously to diminish I love you, but we say I love you to our children all the time. Every night before I tuck them in, as I'm putting them down, I love you, I love you. We shower them with love. I think sometimes hearing I'm proud of you is just as powerful, if not more powerful. And so in my daily interactions with my children, I try to tell them that I'm proud of them. And I try to follow it with something very specific so they know that I'm not just blowing smoke. Oh, yeah, Dad's proud of me. Dad's proud of me. Blah, blah, blah. Of course he is. He's my father. He's contractually obligated to be proud. So I wanted to take the way that I try to treat my children and put it in book form. And it's easy to be proud of our children, when they achieve great things, when they graduate from high school and college, when they get that first job, when they ride a bike without training wheels for the first time. But I think that there's even more value in making sure that they know that we're just as proud of them for the micro as we are about the macro. And so that's what the book was about. It was about those small moments when a kid's growing up and you're able to actually see them do something for the first time. You're able to see them overcome a fear or an obstacle, and you're watching them do something that they maybe didn't think they could do. And you say right after, I'm proud of you. And that's all the book is. It's a book of the ways in which I have been proud of my son and my daughter over the last 10 and 7 years, respectively.
Well, your kids sound kind of cynical like mine are, and I'm wondering if they had any constructive feedback for you on this one, or if they got a chance to look at it.
Yes. My daughter's feedback was, this is a book about her brother. She wasn't happy about it. I pointed out that she is featured on literally every page in the book, except 2 pages. And she apparently had gone through and counted that and acknowledged that that was accurate. But she said, well, I'm not on the cover. And so even at 7 years old, she understands that being on the cover is the most important thing. So obviously now, said I'm going to have to write a second book. And the working title is I'm Proud of You Too. When I wrote the book, my daughter was much younger, and I didn't realize she was going to have as many opinions as she does now. It is largely a love letter to fatherhood and rearing my son. But again, she's right there on every page. And I do write about in the book, one of the things I am proud of with regard to him is the kind of brother that he is becoming. And so that was the constructive criticism from her. From him, no surprise, he liked it. And he thought that it was pretty well done. He especially enjoyed the illustrations. It's funny because on the cover, he's holding a baseball. And he doesn't play baseball. He's never played baseball. And I may be giving you a little too much inside baseball here, but he plays flag football. But there were some concerns about having a kid holding a football at this age on the cover.
Yeah, should he be wearing a helmet?
Correct. I got to a point, I was like, you know what, fine. It'll be an inside joke with my son and I forever. He'll just hold the baseball. So yes, that's the only piece of the book that is inaccurate, I would say.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're still early in your children's book career, Craig, so there's plenty of time to make adjustments.
Sid, I could write 3 more books and dedicate all of them to my daughter, and I would still catch flack. So I've resigned myself to it. But she flipped through it, and she can read fairly well now for a first grader. And she was kind of nodding along, and she also pointed out, well, this woman who's supposed to be our grandma, that doesn't look like Gigi. I'm like, sweetie, I didn't take pictures of family members, and that's not how this process works. And she's like, well, but Del kind of looks like Del. And so finally, I took the book away from her, and that was it. It's a lot of unsolicited feedback.
It's all part of the learning experience.
Yes, yes, sir. That's a good way of looking at it.
Well, I want to come back to the book in a second, but first I want to ask you a little bit about growing up in South Carolina. You're born and raised in Columbia, which is a state capital. Tell me a little bit about the house that you grew up in.
Oh, that's a very specific question, Sid. I grew up in a neighborhood called Pine Valley off Broad River Road. We moved there in 1986. Prior to 86, we lived in some apartments also in Columbia. And in 86, we moved after my first grade year. More space, a little nicer, had a front yard, backyard. It was a neighborhood. We moved into a neighborhood. It was my first house. I moved into my first house when I was 7 years old and started elementary school at St. Andrews Elementary, not too far from where the house was. But it was one of those neighborhoods where back in the mid to late 80s, it was an accurate representation of the demographics of our country. Next door neighbors were a white family with kids who were similarly aged across the street. There was another white family, a woman who'd been in the neighborhood a little bit longer, Betty Comer, her son Stuart. It's so funny because as I'm saying this to you, I can visualize the house in the neighborhood. To the right of us, we had the round trees. There were three round tree children. One of them grew up with my younger brother, and the other two were younger than my younger brother and I. And then facing our house and to the left, the Viscontis, Joe and Nona Visconti, an Italian family who'd been in the neighborhood for, I think, longer than anybody else at that point on the street. He'd retired from the post office. He spent a lot of time sitting in his garage. He used to drink beer with my dad occasionally. He'd smoke some cigarettes. And there was a known rule in the neighborhood that you did not disturb the Viscontis between the hours of 10:55 a.m. and 12:05 p.m. because they were either getting ready for or watching The Price is Right. Every day. Every day. That was their routine. And to the left of the Viscontis, we had the Najums. They were a Lebanese family. The dad ran a hair salon along with the mom, and they were the only ones on the block that had a pool in the backyard. And Daniel Najum, he's a doctor now, but he was a year behind me in school. And he had an older sister named Nancy, who we'll just say was perhaps my first neighborhood crush, even though she was 5 years older. But sometimes you'd go over to the Najum house to hang out by the pool because there was a chance that Nancy might just come out and jump into the pool. And then on the corner, Lily Fong and her family, they ran the neighborhood Chinese restaurant. I mean, it really was a melting pot. And one of the things that's sad about the neighborhood now is it's become, you know, white flight personified. Everyone's sort of left the neighborhood. They've moved farther out, bigger houses, nicer neighborhoods, better schools. And my parents have stayed and the Roundtrees have stayed. And everyone else has either moved or died. And I think, unfortunately, that's the case in a lot of neighborhoods from that era in this country right now. But my growing up, for me, it could not have been, in terms of location, more idyllic. It really was. I still have fond memories of riding my bike around the neighborhood. I walked to school. I walked to high school. I didn't get a car until I was in college because I didn't need one. And my parents were really cheap. Yeah, that was probably more information than you wanted, Sid. But
well, I think that's great. It really sort of paints a picture. And what a place to grow up. I mean, to be exposed to all those different types of families really is kind of a little snapshot of America.
And it's funny because I still keep in touch with a lot of folks from the old neighborhood. In fact, I was just emailing with Breanne Roundtree, who used to live next door because they were coming up to the city and wanted to swing by the show. I was in Columbia last year and I ran into Dr. Daniel Najum, who's a practicing doctor there in Columbia. And I still email and text with other folks in the neighborhood. And my mother, who is the NBC of Pine Valley, if you will, provides me with regular updates, large and small.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned your mom because I want to kind of zero in on a very specific part of the house, and that is the kitchen.
Oh, yes.
We always talk a little bit about food on this podcast. So I know your mom's a great cook, and we've talked to your mom about her cooking, and I've heard you talk about it plenty on the show. But tell me about, you know, what does your mom look like in that kitchen, and what are some things that she was making on the regular?
Oh, gosh. It's funny because, again, we're talking late 80s. Early 90s, before everyone became concerned about carbs and health and fat and sugar and all that stuff. So, you know, growing up, there was a lot of rice and gravy, fried pork chops during the week, not uncommon, fried chicken during the week, not uncommon. But if she was in a rush, we'd get a spaghetti with meat sauce, grits sometimes during the week for breakfast. I mean, mom spent a lot of time in the kitchen. In fact, there was a time when I would say between the ages of 7 and 11 or 12, my mom would actually bake cakes and sell them to people. She did a lot of baking, but she was always cooking something. There was always a meal being prepared. I was probably 15 before I realized that wasn't necessarily common. And she even now talks about missing that part of being a parent. When you have kids to cook for and kids' friends to cook for, there's always a reason to cook. Well, now it's just the two of them. She doesn't cook as often. But You know, her mac and cheese is the stuff of legend still. She also makes a great potato salad. In fact, I guess I can tell you, I don't think it's embargoed. There may or may not be a Today Show cookbook in the works.
Okay.
And one of the recipes is perhaps, maybe going to be my mom's potato salad, which again, it's not healthy. There's nothing low fat in it, and she could care less. The challenge, Sid, sometimes is when you say to her, you're like, Mom, you know, I really like this thing that you made. Can you give me the recipe? And she's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, like, walk me through how you made it. Well, you know, it's a little bit of this and maybe a half stick. And then you, well, how long do you, you kind of just have to look at it. And so what ends up happening, it happened with the mac and cheese recipe. It's happening with the potato salad, even banana pudding. She spends several days trying to recreate a dish and actually measuring stuff. And she gets a little frustrated because she doesn't understand why people who might go online can't just look at something and say, you know what? I could use a little bit more butter. Or I should probably cook this a little longer. Even just yesterday in the Today Show test kitchen, our lead food stylist was trying to recreate this particular recipe that my mom had made for the website. And she basically said, your mother's measurements that she sent, these are not right. And so then I have to call mom. I'm like, Mom, you said, oh, no, it's not. No, that's not. That's not enough. That's my fault. That's how we cook in the South. It's this measuring cup and the spoons. These are newfangled gadgets that we're just getting used to.
Well, your mom's mac and cheese, I can tell you, is very popular on southernliving.com. People love that recipe. They are obsessed with it. So she's doing something right for sure.
Our apologies to all of the cardiologists. My wife only permits me to have it, you know, maybe a half dozen times a year. But growing up, I mean, I was eating that mac and cheese every week. Just the mac and cheese. I mean, mom would make, you know, collard greens, like foods that are now eaten on special occasions were foods that we would consume sometimes on just a random Wednesday. And I miss that. But that being said, if I had continued to live like that, Sid, I probably wouldn't be having this conversation with you right now. So there is that.
Moderation is key.
Sid, do you remember Kool-Aid?
Oh, sure.
So growing up, there was always, at least in our fridge, you had a pitcher of Kool-Aid for the kids and a pitcher of sweet tea for the adults. It was always there. Took it for granted.
Yeah, with about 900 grams of sugar in it. Yeah.
And again, I was probably in the 10th or 11th grade before I realized, you know what? Maybe that's not healthy. My mother, to this day, when she comes to Connecticut and we'll go out to dinner, she will order sweet tea. I'm like, Mom, why do you do this? Because the waiter, waitress, invariably, they look at her like she's got three heads and like sweet tea. She's like, yeah, it's like tea with sugar in it. And they're like, oh, man, we have unsweetened tea, but we can bring you some sugar.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
No. And then I sit there and I watch her take like 8 packets of sugar and stir it in. I'm like, Mom, you're not supposed to have the sugar. That's why they don't offer sweet tea at the restaurants anymore. We've all discovered that sugar kills you. And she's decided that if she's going to go out, she's at least going to go out all sugared up, I suppose.
Well, I like her style.
So do I.
After the break, I'll talk more with Craig Melvin about navigating his father's addiction issues, how both of his parents show their support for him these days, and what he's learned from other dads and interviews on the Today Show. This episode of Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living is presented by Boar's Head. Introducing Sweet Bee's Honey Barbecue Glazed Chicken, a new classic flavor available only from Boar's Head that brings the celebrated traditions, signature flavors, and iconic taste of sweet honey barbecue to your local deli. Inspired by famous barbecue joints and the aficionados who know the reward is worth the wait, comes an authentic experience that can only be from Boar's Head. Made with premium ingredients, this slow-roasted chicken is delightfully sweet with notes of honey and perfectly balanced with savory hints of hickory smoke. Honey drizzled and barbecue sizzled. Ask for freshly sliced Sweet Bee's Honey Barbecue Chicken during your next visit to the deli counter. Boar's Head. Compromise elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living. I'm Sid Evans, and today I'm talking with one of the co-hosts of the Today Show, Craig Melvin. Craig, I want to go back to your dad for a second. You mentioned the book that you wrote about him called Pops and all his struggles with alcoholism and how hard that was for the whole family. Why did you want to share that story?
It's a good question, Sid, because I'm one of those people that tends to believe that we live in an era where people generally overshare. But during the course of therapy, my therapist at the time convinced me that, first of all, I had developed some issues that were the result of unresolved issues with my father, things that I just had not talked to him about, things that had affected me for years, and I didn't realize it until I started talking about them, and at that point, writing about them. And she maintained that there were literally millions of people who had similar stories that might benefit from reading my story, hearing my story. And so I did it for them. I did it to help myself heal, but I also did it for my dad. Because, you know, as our parents age, they start to reflect a little bit more on their lives and their children and their regrets. And my father had started to do this thing where every time we hung out or I talked to him, even when he had gotten sober, he would apologize for all those years that he felt like he'd wasted and all the time that he felt like he'd squandered with us because of the addiction, as a result of the gambling, as a result of the drinking. And I wanted him to know that we'd forgiven him, that I'd forgiven him, that he was and is partially responsible for the man I've become. So I wanted him to know that before he left this earth. So it was a love letter to my dad, first and foremost. And I made that clear with the publisher before I started this process. I said, if, you know, if the book helps people, great. That's obviously one of the chief goals. But the primary goal is to write a book about redemption and forgiveness and love that my father can pick up and read and can say, oh, okay, it's all here. It was also, Sid, to be able to interview my dad. I spent 6-7 hours just peppering him with all of the questions that I wanted to ask him over the years for this book. And I recorded all of those conversations. That was a highlight for me.
Yeah. Did you share this new book with him?
I did not, actually, deliberately. First of all, he's a bit of a Luddite. And the digital version, he wouldn't have read it because he doesn't have an email address. And no, that's not a joke. He does not have an email address. By the way, he also doesn't have a credit card or a debit card.
Wow.
If you only knew, Sid, if you only knew. Even to this day, I'm amazed that he's able to function in modern society, but somehow he does. So the hard copy of the book, I actually just got my first one a couple of weeks ago. So I wanted to give him a hard copy so that he could enjoy that.
Well, I'm sure he'll be very excited to see it.
I think you're right. My mom saw it. She was very excited. She was very proud. It's funny how, Sid, I don't care how old you are or what you do professionally or any modicum of worldly success that you might achieve. Knowing your parents are proud of you, it matters. Even now, in the mornings, I'll get a few million people that'll watch the show, which is great. I don't take that for granted. It's not lost on me. But it's when I get a text message from my mom who say, oh, you know, I saw that interview you did with blah, blah, blah. I was good.
Uh-huh.
Or if you talk to your dad and your dad's like, oh, I saw you. You remember that interview you did with Dawn Staley on, you tell her, I said, blah, blah. Even after all these years, it makes me feel some sort of way. First of all, to know that they still watch. Because I've been doing it for a while now. And they both watch all 3 hours. And I've said to them before, I was like, you know, you don't really have to watch the whole show. Like, every day. It's okay. I won't be offended. And they're offended at me even suggesting that they don't watch.
Well, it's their version of The Price is Right. You know?
That's right. That's a valid point. I guess you're right. I guess you're right. What's funny, though, is I'll get feedback, shall we say. I've got this focus group that I guess my mother has. So someone will text her to tell me something about the show. Or they'll text her with a question. Usually it's about a food segment. It's like, I saw Craig trying that dish. was it really as good as he made it look like it was, or was he just faking for TV? And so invariably a few times every week, I have to respond to the focus group text messages that I get from my mother's friends from church.
Well, Craig, I want to ask you about being a dad yourself. And, you know, you've written this really powerful book about your dad. Now you've got this children's book, and you've done all kinds of segments on the Today Show about being a dad, and you've interviewed all sorts of dads in all different kinds of situations. It's such a challenging time to be a dad. It's always been challenging, but, you know, doing it in 2024 is tough with everything going on, social media and all that. What's some of the best advice that you've gotten through all these interviews and all the talking that you've done about being a dad right now?
There have been a couple of nuggets. The first came from Carson Daly, who years ago, we were on a shoot and I was sort of lamenting the fact that at that particular point, I was traveling a lot more than I do now. And I was missing stuff. You know, I was missing soccer games. And I was missing ballet and gymnastics meets and all that stuff. I was feeling sort of guilty about it. And, you know, Carson's got four children. And he said to me, he's like, you got to focus on quality over quantity. And you got to accept the fact that you're not going to be able to be there as often as your wife because you're working. And the work is important. And you got to make peace with it or you're going to be guilty for 18 years at least. Focus on quality over quantity. So when I am there, I'm not just physically present, I'm emotionally present. I try to make sure my children know that. I've also blocked out certain days and activities where unless something terrible has happened in the world, I'm there. So for instance, I've coached my son's basketball team for the last three seasons. It's a mediocre squad, probably a result of the coaching more than anything. But anyway, he enjoys it. I enjoy coaching. I've done it for the last 3 years. And I've got a buddy in town, and he's my assistant coach. And he basically promised me that if I had to travel last minute or do something, that he would step in, which he's done. I block out Wednesday evenings during basketball season so I can always be at practice. And so I carve out that time. And people who work with me, they know that no matter what, that's, I call it dead time. I'm unreachable and untouchable. And I've done the same thing with my daughter, although it's different because she has not demonstrated any interest so far, at least, in organized recreational sports. But I try to be physically present as much as humanly possible because one of the dads told me from the Dad's Got This series on the Today Show, you know, as kids get older, a lot of the things that we think they care about, they don't really care about. And they don't really remember a lot of the stuff that we think that it's going to stay with them forever. They remember like looking out from that stage, seeing mom, seeing dad during their play. They remember being at that basketball game and dad, God bless, I hated when I do this. When, you know, when dad was the coach, they remember that. And I know they remember that because, you know, for years, for me, excuse me, it's dusty in the office. Here. For years, one of the biggest issues I had with my dad, he just wasn't there. He wasn't physically present. He was at the house, but he wasn't at the baseball games. He wasn't at the basketball games. And it wasn't until I became a father that I realized, well, dang, he wasn't there because he was working third shift for almost 40 years at the post office. He slept during the day. Yeah, he drank too much, and sometimes he was passed out or, you know, up at the corner store. Yeah, that was part of it, but the other part was he just couldn't be there because he was working to provide for his family. And until you have that responsibility, you don't fully appreciate. You kind of have to be there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Craig, I just have one more question for you. I'll end on this one. What does it mean to you to be Southern?
Oh, gosh, that's a good last question. For me, at least, being Southern, it's not about geography. It's not about being born in Alabama or South Carolina. It's a state of mind. And the older I get, the more I have come to believe that. Perhaps it's because I live outside New York City in Connecticut, and I'm surrounded by a lot of people who rarely travel outside the tri-state area. But it really is, it's a state of mind. It is about being deliberate. It's about being honest. It's about being sometimes slower than the average in terms of speech and walking. It's funny because even now, my colleagues will give me grief because it takes me a little bit longer sometimes to get through a story than most of my colleagues. And if we're running tight on time on the Today Show, someone will get in my ear and they'll say, "All right, Craig, I need you to give me your Connecticut read here, not your South Carolina read. We got to save about 10 seconds. So I need," and so sometimes I'll have to talk deliberately faster than I normally would. But it's a way of life. It's why every year I make sure that, you know, my kids spend at least a week along the coast in South Carolina. We're back for holidays. And some family members point out that after a few days of me being in South Carolina, they're like, "Oh, your dialect, it's not so nondescript anymore. You're using y'alls again."
It comes back quick.
It does come back quick. And every now and then when I come back to work, someone will say, "Oh, you've spent some time down south, haven't you?" I mean, listen, I sometimes catch flack in my house because I not only make grits most weekends, I have them shipped in from Adloo, you know? When we land in Charlotte, I go to Bojangles. I get the chicken biscuit. The very first place that my parents met my now wife's then girlfriend, we had breakfast at Lizard's Thicket on Broadway Road, Columbia. So I still go back to all the same places. I eat all the same things. Some might say it's a little sad that I'm such a creature of habit. I tend to relish in it. I don't know. That's just me.
Well, stay Southern, Craig, and congrats on the book. It's really great, and I know you're excited to get it out in the world. Thanks so much for being on Biscuits and Jam.
Sid, thank you. Thank you so much. Again, I always enjoy Biscuits and Jam, so an honor to be here.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Craig Melvin. Southern Living is based in Birmingham, Alabama. Be sure to follow Biscuits and Jam on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And we would love your feedback. If you could rate this podcast and leave us a review, we'd really appreciate it. You can also find us online at southernliving.com/biscuitsandjam. Our theme song is by Sean Watkins of Nickel Creek. I hope you'll join me next week when I'll be speaking with the country star and former American Idol winner, Scotty McCreery. We'll see you then.